This is Africa on Fire on KBOO Radio. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Timbuktunes, a CD shop specializing in music from around the world, including a large selection from Africa and the African diaspora, celebrating cultural diversity through sound. Timbuktunes is located at 4726 Southeast Hawthorne in Portland and is open Tuesday through Saturday. More information at 503-239-0179 or timbuktunes.com. Welcome to Africa on Fire. Mark your calendars. We're pleased to announce that Africa on Fire now airs every first Thursday from 6 to 7 p.m. Africa on Fire is the only Pacific Northwest news and public affairs radio program dedicated to Africa and her people. In this hour, we will speak with Egyptian-American filmmaker Sarah Rashad about female genital mutilation. A local interpreter discusses cultural sensitivity in area medical facilities. Kenya's Nobel Peace Prize winner visits Oregon. And Portland's first Genocide Awareness Week focuses on Darfur, Sudan. Plus more international and local African news the corporate media won't divulge. I'm your host, Marianne Fry. Tonight's guest co-host is Eritrean-born Portlander, Sonia Damtu. Join us. Africa is on fire.
Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire.
Coming up later in this hour, we have many local African events to tell you about. We turn now to Africa on Fire's international African news. An Egyptian man received an unprecedented settlement from the United States government following his illegal detainment after September 11, 2001 attacks. Ahab Al-Maghrabi, a Muslim, received $300,000 after being held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn, New York for nearly a year. According to his lawsuit, he was subject to daily and systemic physical and verbal abuse, including strip searches and being chained. He also suffered sexual abuse. This week, he told Democracy Now! News that other Arab prisoners suffered the same daily treatment and that he thought his detainment would, quote, be the end of my life. Al-Maghrabi, now in Egypt, continues to have medical and financial problems related to his unlawful detainment.
Free Speech Radio reports that Yale University has joined Stanford and a few other universities in encouraging divestments from Sudan to help bring peace to the Darfur region. Yale recently announced it will not invest in oil companies doing business in Sudan. It will drop holdings in at least one oil company there. The decision follows a report by the International Human Rights Clinic at Yale Law School, which cited governmental support in genocide killings. Oil revenue reportedly makes up half of Sudan's budget.
10 South African companies listed on the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange brought in $20 billion in shares in 2005. This is a 40% increase since 2004. The best South African performers in the United States were Sasol, a chemical and fuel company, which grew by 64%. Highveld Steel and Vanadium, Gold Fields, Harmony Gold, and Anglo Gold Ashanti spiked over 40%. Media company Naspers fared well, as did telecommunications giant Telkom. The best 2004 performers were Latin American firms, followed closely by South Africa and Israel. In related news, South Africa's Randgold and Exploration was delisted from the NASDAQ last year over allegations of fraud. Mining magnate Brett Kebble was forced to resign last fall. Shortly thereafter, he was ambushed and murdered by a rare low-velocity bullet similar to those used by security personnel. Kebble had close ties with the African National Congress and the ANC Youth League and was viewed by some as a black economic empowerment visionary. This according to South Africa's Business Day.
There has been almost 50% decline in HIV prevalence in some groups in Zimbabwe, according to research published in Science magazine. HIV prevalence has dropped almost 50% by women up to 24 years of age. There has been a 23% drop in HIV in men aged 17 to 29. Researchers from the Imperial College of London and the Biomedical Research and Training Institute in Zimbabwe attributed the decline to the number of casual sexual relationships, delay in the onset of sexual activity, and increases in condom use.
An Australian company affiliated with the World Bank allegedly provided support to the Democratic Republic of Congo Army in connection to the killings of 100 civilians. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation found that Australia's Anvil mining trucks were used to transport army troops to repress a 2004 uprising. Mining employees then reportedly removed corpses killed by the army. Advocacy and environmental groups complained that an internal World Bank report on the Dikalusha copper and silver mining project was withheld until last month. They alleged that Bank President Paul Wolfowitz was reluctant to disclose its contents for fear of implicating the institution in bloodshed.
Construction of a hydroelectric dam begins along Cameroon's Lom River, while environmentalists questioned the initiative. Non-governmental groups claimed that the project will completely alter the lives of about 30,000 indigenous inhabitants of the area, notably the Baka and the Bakakol pygmy groups. There is fear that the dam will place their land underwater, as well as destroy medicinal plants and treasured ancestral relics. The dam is also expected to flood the Panjerem Animal Reserve, already affected by a railway and Chad-Cameroon oil pipeline. The Interpress Service reports that more than $120 million are needed to build the dam. Cameroon is expected to borrow these funds from the World Bank.
Dowry-related murder and abuse cases regularly occurring in India quietly happen within Uganda's Indian community as well. Some Indians believe Uganda's criminal laws have no bearing on the Indian culture of forced marriages. Indian sources in Kampala told the New Vision newspaper that most girls who oppose arranged marriages are deported to India, where they are pressured until they yield to an arranged marriage. Uganda's proposed domestic relations bill has been shelved. It is believed that without clear laws to address dowry issues in Uganda, dowry-related deaths, often deemed suicides by husbands, could escalate. Indians represent the majority of 2 million minorities in Uganda.
Nigerian bankers were shamed for their discriminatory practices against women at the recent World Social Forum in Bamako, Mali. Nigerian banks insist on the active employment of single women and that single women not be pregnant for a certain period. Married women are exempt from these policies. The forum also addressed the overall lack of protection of workers across Africa, including insurance, pension, employment insecurity, unhealthy working conditions, low pay, and child workers. This according to Vanguard paper in Lagos, Nigeria.
The Kirondo News Agency reports that Rwandan genocide survivors plan to sue a French journalist for his revisionist remarks about the 1994 genocide there. The organization Ibuka plans to sue Pierre Pion in France and Belgium over his book Black Fury, White Liars. The organization claims the book is a radical, racist publication that promotes hatred toward the Tutsi ethnic group. Approximately 1 million Tutsis died in the Rwandan genocide.
It was only months ago that the legal status of women in Swaziland was elevated from that of a minor to an adult. With that comes new legal rights. The Swaziland branch of Women in Law in South Africa has launched an awareness campaign to teach HIV-positive women about their legal rights, according to the United Nations. HIV prevalence is estimated at 40% in Swaziland. The biggest obstacle preventing women from seeking any type of legal redress is their inability to pay legal fees. 2 out of 3 Swazis live in chronic poverty. The women suffer in this traditionally paternalistic society.
The tabloid newspaper L'Antidote published a list of 50 reported homosexuals in Cameroon, most of them well-known high-ranking members of society. It categorized alleged homosexuals, mostly men, according to their occupations. The newspaper sold out quickly, prompting other papers to publish similar lists. L'Antidote publisher Jean-Pierre Amuga-Balinga said their publication is part of the social responsibility of journalists to combat societal ills. He said conscientious journalists must fight against homosexuality that is both immoral and illegal in Cameroon at this time when it is, quote, fortunately not yet widespread. This according to Cameroon's Post newspaper.
The Malawi government is to roll out a new national registry to protect children. Malawi's Chronicle newspaper reports that the national registration and identification system will legally identify children as citizens and provide universal and compulsory birth and death certificates. This bill is expected to help reduce child labor, child trafficking, forced early marriages, and other child abuses. In addition, AIDS orphans are currently denied rights to inherit parental property because they do not have a birth certificate providing legal proof of their identity and family ties. The NRIS seeks to help reduce child deaths from preventable diseases due in part to an effective system of birth registration.
45% of Burundi's 2006 emergency plan money is now slated to feed its citizens. The government said it will distribute food to almost a quarter of a million families, equaling 30% of the country's people. This is to occur between now and May. Money from this emergency plan is supposed to cover the rehabilitation of school and health infrastructure, according to the United Nations. You've been listening to International African News on Africa on Fire. I'm Marianne Fry with guest co-host Sonia Damtu. When we come back, we'll hear from Egyptian-American Sarah Rashad. Tomorrow evening, Sarah Rashad, a first-generation Egyptian-American, will be presenting her film about female genital mutilation at the Cascade Festival of African Films at Portland Community College Cascade Campus. We spoke with Sarah from Los Angeles this last Sunday. Sarah, I know you just arrived in Los Angeles hours ago from a film festival in Berlin, which you were invited to be a presenting director, and you've also been in Egypt and the Middle East in the past week. So thank you so much for joining us now on Africa on Fire.
Thank you so much for having me.
First and foremost, Sarah, our condolences to Egyptians on the loss of 1,000 people in the Red Sea ferry boat sinking last month on February 3rd. To recap the news for our listeners, Egyptian newspapers report that the ferry caught fire on a 30-mile stretch between Saudi Arabia and Egypt. Most of the passengers were low-income Egyptians returning from working in Saudi Arabia and other countries. The Egyptian government has been accused of protecting the ship's owner, who is close to a top government official. Two other ferries owned by the company have sunk in the past 10 years without proper government investigation. Relatives of the dead rioted last month at the ferry owner's offices after days without news of their loved ones. Sarah, you were in Egypt when the ferry sank. What have Egyptians been saying about this tragedy?
Egyptians were really, really upset about the tragedy, especially because many foreign governments offered help and assistance when it actually happened. And, you know, the Egyptian government refused assistance. That's the most upsetting point for Egyptians because, you know, something could have been done, but they simply refused to get any help whatsoever. The Americans offered assistance, for example, when they found out there was a fire. There was a fire, and, you know, when other governments offered to send out ships and stop the fire, the Egyptians refused. They refused to have any foreign interference whatsoever.
Okay.
So that's the most upsetting point. They're either covering something up or they're totally irresponsible. Either way, a lot of people died.
Yes.
So Egyptians are very upset.
Sarah, thank you. And again, our condolences and the loss of those lives.
Thank you.
We move on now to talk about female genital mutilation, the subject of Sarah Rashad's film Tahara, which she will present tomorrow in Portland. It was the winner of the Best Short Film Award at the 2005 Pan-African Film Festival in Los Angeles. Female genital mutilation is practiced in roughly 28 of 58 African countries. The World Health Organization estimates that between 100 and 140 million girls and women have undergone female genital mutilation. 2 million more girls are at risk of undergoing this cultural practice, also known as female circumcision. This continues to be a controversial subject both in Africa and the United States. Sarah, can you define for us what female genital mutilation is?
There's three types, And the first type is called clitorectomy, and that's where they cut off just the tip of the clitoris. Okay, the second type, they cut off the tip of the clitoris and a little bit more. And the third type is infibulation. They cut everything off and sew the girl closed. And that's called infibulation. That's the most extreme form.
And what are the medical, sexual, and other consequences of this procedure?
If you have the first type, some of these girls have no, side effects, to be honest with you. Except, you know, I'm sure that they do have sexual, repercussions. However, an official study has never been done. From the second type to the third type, the girls go through a lot of hardship. For example, when they're having babies, the women who are infibulated have to get cut up and opened when they're having a child. And then they usually get re-sewn after childbirth. So these women have a lot of bleeding and suffering due to their circumcisions. So it varies. From type 1 to type 3, it varies. You also have the case of type 1, where a girl can get circumcised with type 1, and she also, you know, might have an extreme reaction and end up bleeding to death, for example. So there's lots of different repercussions. Again, you can also have a girl who has a circumcision and has no effect whatsoever.
Sarah, in some cultures valuing female genital mutilation, it is extremely difficult, if not impossible, for women to marry if they've undergone this procedure. Most often parents, husbands, and strong cultures make decisions for girls and women in this matter. What are some of the consequences of not following this procedure in such cultures?
In some cultures, it is really difficult for the girls to get marriage partners if they're not circumcised, because the societies, you know, are so entrenched with this practice, and they're finding it hard to let go of it. This is the main point. It's the point of marriage, as you mentioned. I'm happy to say that many places are changing, and a lot of men are now refusing to marry circumcised women. So there is a lot of positive change in the movement. Slowly, you are seeing entire villages give up the tradition. In Egypt, for example, you know, I've spoken to a lot of men about the issue, and this is just in casual conversations. When they find out that I'm making a film about female circumcision, they start discussing it with me, and this is the mentality of the younger generation who I'm talking to. They say that they refuse to marry circumcised women because they don't feel that the women are as sexually warm as, you know, other women. This is a culture where they don't have traditional premarital relationships, okay? But the men are saying, you know, this is not what I want for my future wife. So in Egypt, for example, it's changing. And in Egypt, they have a statistic of 90% being circumcised.
Some believe that female genital mutilation is a Muslim practice and is demanded by the Islamic faith. In fact, this practice predates Islam. Why do you think that this myth continues to be perpetuated when other religions, including Christianity, are involved?
People in power sometimes use religion, you know, especially in the case of Islam, to subjugate women. And I hate to say that, but this is what's happening with the case of circumcision as an example. This is a women's rights issue. They, you know, want to keep women oppressed for some reason that serves their political agenda.
And you report that in the United States alone, more than 168,000 women and girls either had or are at risk for female genital mutilation, and that almost two-thirds of these females reside in either California or New York. Your film, Tahara, shows a secretive place where this practice takes place. Are there such back-alley clinics in the United States illegally performing this procedure?
There are cases of doctors performing their procedure. There are cases of dayas who live in the country and perform the procedure in their homes in secret. A daya is a traditional circumciser, and she's also the woman who helps, for example, with a girl's, you know, wedding and stuff like that. I mean, she does a lot of functions, but in particular circumcision, and also it can be done by a barber or a doctor. There's, you know, doctors, dayas, and barbers. So it goes to all levels. There's also the case of girls being born here in the United States who are actually Americans, and their parents taking them outside of the country to get the procedure done in their home country. These three things are happening. And, you know, they're all actually in the United States, it's illegal. You know, if the girl is American and they take her back to her country and then bring her back circumcised, it is sort of breaking the law, actually, of being a citizen here. You know, and the same thing is actually happening throughout Europe. Now, if you look at it on the global level, circumcision is now illegal in most countries where you have the highest case. In Egypt, for example, 90%. It is illegal in most practicing countries, but it's still happening. Everywhere it's still happening underground.
This is a short film clip for Tahara.
Good. Everything is fine.
I came today actually about Soha.
Is she okay?
Oh, yes, she's fine. She's growing up so quickly. We think it's about time to get her circumcised. And I have her outside. Perhaps we could do it now.
I think it's a bad idea. Her health might be affected.
I trust you, Dr. Anir.
She could die.
I lived through it.
Amina, you're here every 3 months with urinary tract infections.
It was done wrong.
Your prolonged menstrual cycles.
But you are going to do it in a sterile fashion.
You don't understand, do you? No normal woman goes through that.
I will pay you $1,000.
I can't do it.
I will sign whatever papers you need me to sign. You can wash your hands off it.
Do you want me to lose my license?
It will only take 10 minutes. No one will know.
No, I can't do it. There is no medical justification for this cultural practice. And if you go through with that, I'm obligated to report you. Now please leave.
There have been cases reported in the U.S. of physicians being caught, doing this. Actually, no prosecution in the U.S., but myself and a friend helped report a guy who was advertising illegal circumcisions. It was California, and he did get interviewed by the FBI, and he did get arrested. This happened 2 years ago, but there was no publicity on it. And there was a case also in Paris many, many years ago of a girl 18 years old, taking her own family actually to court for her circumcision when she became 18. And there was a dayah arrested for that.
Female genital mutilation is administered any time shortly after birth to during the first pregnancy. Is that right?
In every culture, it's different. It's literally some people are circumcising when their daughters are very, very young, as just born. Some other cultures circumcise before marriage, okay, a week before marriage. So it really varies from country to country and even village to village.
The World Health Organization reports that the average age of female genital mutilation is falling and is no longer associated with initiation into adulthood. Why the change?
Quite possibly the change, if the age is falling, is so that the girls no longer have any say in the matter. In my research, younger girls are getting educated at school, for example, and in one village in particular where I studied, the girls were 10 years old, and they refused. They stood up against their own parents for the circumcision, but the reason they had to do that by a group effort, it was one girl who was going to get circumcised, and the girls were educated at school, and then the girls decided we don't want to have circumcision anymore. Then all the girls, like 50 young girls, went over to this one girl's house and confronted her parents. There is education out there, slowly, slowly. Girls are getting educated at school, for example, and they are standing up against things that they don't agree with.
If you're just joining us, this is Africa on Fire. I'm Marianne Fry with Aaron Yankee and Sonia Damtu. We're talking with Egyptian-American filmmaker Sarah Rashad about female genital mutilation. Her film Tahara shows tomorrow evening in Portland at the Cascade Festival of African Films. You interviewed many Egyptian women in Egypt from diverse backgrounds for your film. What did they have to say?
When I originally had the script, I had set the story in Egypt. And when I workshopped my script, through many, many villages with Egyptian women in the villages. They were not happy with that, and then I came up with the idea of setting it in America. They were more responsive to the film once I changed the location to America, because the main point for them was, you know, female circumcision has been discussed in the media for all these years, and da-da-da-da-da, and they always feel under attack. Like, we're going in there and attacking one of their cultural traditions, whether they agree with it or not. They don't like the way media is used in this way. So I said, okay, why don't I set it in the United States, you know, globalize the issue. And I read the script to them. They were very, very excited about seeing the finished film. So I'm very enthusiastic about getting the film screened in the villages now that it's finished.
What negative feedback have you received bringing this controversial subject to light?
In the process of making the film, everybody was worried about the whole religious discussion. Is it going to seem like it's something to do with Islam, et cetera, et cetera? And I was attacked for that. My characters are, you know, Muslim in the film, but I don't discuss the issue of religion. That's the point. You know, I mean, yes, a lot of Muslims practice this, but I don't discuss that it's something having to do with Islam or whatever. I keep the whole religious discussion out of it.
How does your family feel about you making a film about female genital mutilation?
My family was not happy about it at first, and actually I didn't tell them about the film for a very long time, and then they heard about it from a newspaper article that was written about my film that I didn't know about. That's how they initially found out about the film, and then they started criticizing me about it. I had one uncle in particular who's a religious, and he was attacking me about that factor. Why are you discussing something with our religion? And I told him it doesn't have anything to do with religion, and I'm going to discuss what I want. Finally, they laid off. They haven't seen the film yet, and I think that when they see the film, they will really enjoy it, to be honest with you. It's the whole defensiveness that people have. The media has portrayed some things in the wrong way. So you're always working against this defensiveness when you're a filmmaker. It doesn't really matter what kind of film you're making.
Did you tell your family, or did they read about the fact that you won an award last year for Tahereh?
Actually, I did stop discussing the film with them a long time ago, but I have a video copy, and there are, you know, especially the women do want to see the film, and I have a lot of doctors in my family, so I will show them the film. I sort of had to go through my own success and get the awards and prizes. Now I have the confidence to show my family my film. I mean, it's really hard when you're doing work, and not even your family supports your work. You know, it's very, very difficult.
Americans are incensed, sometimes quite righteously, about the practice of female genital mutilation, and they want an immediate end to the practice. They perhaps fail to take into account generations and generations of ingrained traditions that are quite difficult, as you know, to change or influence. How do people whose culture does not include FGM help make a change?
They have to go inside of themselves and understand that there are other places besides, you know, the United States, for example, where there are many, many other traditions besides female circumcision. It's one tradition, but child marriages, for example, child labor, for example, I mean, this is not the only thing out there. They have to be a little bit more sensitive of the context. The case of female circumcision has always been so aggressively attacked by big human rights organizations, and it hasn't really helped the issue. You know, what helps the issue is the NGOs who are out there in the villages. A lot of these people are foreigners, interfacing with people and having discussion and dialogue about these things, instead of people always feeling like they're under attack and they must be forced to change. I mean, change is a slow process, especially with an issue like this. People have to, you know, be more open and sensitive to other people's practices. They don't necessarily have to agree with them, but just to be open.
Local African News is next. When we come back, we'll talk with Sarah Rashad about how the practice of female genital mutilation is changing around the world. This is Marianne Fry with Aaron Yankee and Sonia Damtu. Time now for Africa on Fire's local and regional news. Lake Oswego's Itafari organization presents a benefit for Rwandan widows and orphans tomorrow evening, March 3rd. The event featuring African musicians Samputi and Ngali will be held at 7 p.m. at Melody Ballroom, 615 Southeast Alder Street in Portland. Tickets are $35 and $25 for students. Reserve tickets at 1-800-494-TIXS.
Around 5,000 Oregonians have joined the Peace Corps since it began in 1961. University of Oregon, Lewis and Clark, and Willamette University are three of the nation's top schools for Peace Corps recruitment. Celebrate the 45th anniversary of the National Peace Corps this Sunday, March 5th, at Portland State University Smith Memorial Student Union Multicultural Center at 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. The free event will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. For more information, email jcongdon@peacecorps.gov.
Did you know the Ghana Stock Exchange has the best stock market return in the world? Find out about African business during the last week of the Cascade Festival of African Films. Africa Open for Business shows at 2 p.m. Saturday. Other films are tonight, tomorrow, and Saturday night at 7:30 p.m. All films are held at Portland Community College Cascade Campus, Moriarty Building on North Killingsworth and Albina Streets in Portland. For more information about these films, visit AfricanFilmFestival.org. Portland's first Genocide Awareness Week begins March 12th. Highlights include a March 15th workshop at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. with Ruth Messinger, a witness to the Darfur crisis. Workshops will be held at Portland State University, Smith Memorial Union, 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. There will also be presentations that day on Uganda, Rwanda, and the public health effects of genocide. At 7 p.m. on Wednesday, March 15th, Mohamed Yeya of the Dominga Coalition for Freedom and Democracy will speak at PSU's Smith Memorial Multicultural Room. A cultural night will be held on Friday, March 17th, with Zimbabwean performer Loveness Wesa and Sudanese Benson Ding, author of They Poured Fire on Us from the Sky, will speak. That's at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. For more information on these and other events, visit GenocideAwareness.net or call Sarah Stark at 208-739-3308.
The following events will be held this month at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center on North Interstate. Two art exhibits depict African crisis, the AIDS crisis Zimbabwean artists respond. A free exhibit of ceramic tiles will be presented March 8 through April 27 with lectures and videos. Los Angeles painter Beverly Collins presents Women Betrayed, the Invisible Women of Darfur, March 13th to the 19th. World Pulse magazine hosts a fundraiser for the African Women's Coalition. The March 15th event will feature African dancers from Woodlawn Elementary School, musician Chata Ade, African cuisine, and storytelling Baba Wage Jakete. Tickets are $25 to $35. Call 503-984-5334. Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center is located at 5340 North Interstate in Portland. More information available by calling 503-823-9495. A local high school senior is organizing a fundraiser benefiting Ugandan child war victims. The event features African dance, a film on the 20-year-old North Ugandan war, discussion and an auction. Proceeds benefit the non-profit Invisible Children working in Uganda. Student Rachel Goldberg hosts this March 24th event at her school, Pacific Crest Community School, 116 Northeast 29th Avenue in Portland at 7:30 p.m. For more information, call 503-234-2826.
The World Affairs Council presents Kenya's Nobel Peace Prize winner on March 16th. Dr. Wangari Maathai will speak on environment and democracy at the Arlene Snitzer Hall, downtown Portland. Series tickets are $80. Call 503-552-9888 or visit worldoregon.org. Reed College presents the following March lecture at its Volum Lecture Hall, 3203 Southeast Woodstock in Portland. All lectures begin at 7 p.m. and are free of charge. On Monday, March 20th, Susan Rice, former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, presents the national security implications of global poverty. On Monday, March 27th, Christopher Udra, professor of economics at Yale University, speaks on land rights and investments in Ghana. And Portland's Neil Kinney Geyer, head of Mercy Corps, will discuss Darfur, Sudan on March 30th. Call Reed College at 503-777-7755 for more information.
The Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization, IRCO, and TAX, or Technical Assistance for Community Service, received a federal grant to help small immigrant and refugee organizations in Portland. The goal is to provide technical assistance, training, and monetary compensation. For more information, contact Jimmy Dogo at IRCO 503-234-1541.
Seattle's International Bicycle Fund offers cycling trips to Tunisia, Tanzania, Uganda, and Mali this year. Check out ibike.org. Seattle African events are at ibike.org/Africa Matters. Send us your news and events at africaonfire@yahoo.com. In a few minutes, we'll get local commentary about female genital mutilation in the Horn of Africa and in Oregon. We now conclude our interview with filmmaker Sarah Rashad. In 1991, an American news organization shot a real circumcision operation in Egypt. Several Egyptians involved in the filming went to jail. You just spoke to the fact that you changed locations for your film to the United States. But did you have issues relating to Egyptian laws when you were in Egypt?
Yeah, I originally wanted to shoot my flashback sequences in Egypt, but I got no support from the Egyptian censorship board, especially after the CNN clip. I spent many months trying to get my project approved. They completely rejected it. But because of the CNN clip, circumcision in Egypt is now outlawed. You know, female genital mutilation, thank goodness, is actually in the decline, and I'm very happy to say that. Numbers are going down all throughout the world, you know, and there's a lot of aggressive work from individuals and NGOs. My research in Egypt has shown entire villages, you know, abandoning the practice. You know, there's hope for the future.
And Sarah, you spent years working on this project and depleting your own resources. Why was it so important for you to finish this project?
I've always been passionate about this issue. I read a book by Alice Walker, Possessing the Secret of Joy, many, many, many years ago, and that really got me interested in the subject. And then I just started researching it. And once I started researching it and talking to the women, the stories were so powerful, I just couldn't get the issue off of my mind, you know, and the only thing I could do is make a film, you know, because I'm a filmmaker, and I wanted to help the women. So I thought, okay, well, if I can make a film, not a documentary, that actually speaks to them, something that they can sit down and watch, my hope was that they will talk about it and, you know, think about it and change their minds. The film is effective in that capacity. I mean, when circumcised women see my film, they really are deeply affected by it. I've had many cases of women breaking down and crying, and then they start talking about their circumcisions.
There was a woman on your crew who played the grandmother. What happened with her during the film?
I was very frustrated in the casting of the story of the film. I had no Egyptians here. And finally, I luckily found my lead actress. She was here on a Fulbright. And then I called a bunch of Egyptians, and this woman was sitting in the hallway, and I just took one look at her, and I said, okay, I think you're going to play the grandmother, okay? So she agreed on the spot, never acted before, had no idea that I would need her for 12 hours a day. And she just instantly agreed. And then naturally I had her granddaughter, her real granddaughter, play the granddaughter in the film. So one day after rehearsal, Yusreya is her name, broke down and she just had a fit and started crying. And she told us about her circumcision. She almost bled to death. And she confessed, because of the rehearsals of the film, she confessed that for the first time to her own daughter and her granddaughter. She said, and that's why I'm in this film, and that's why I want you all to participate. And she never had the courage to tell that story before. And she said, you know, I almost bled to death, and it's because of, this is why I'm in this film, and that's why none of you are circumcised.
Sarah, you made a 5-minute version of Tahara as a student at the University of Southern California. Many non-governmental organizations fighting to eradicate FGM utilize this film in their work. Can you tell us about that?
The 5-minute film is the first film that I made, and when I saw the responses of African women watching that film, I came up with the idea for the longer film. That short 5-minute film has just been distributed really independently. I mean, through my personal work, when I travel and when I meet people who have organizations, you know, I just give them copies here and there. It's really been sort of a grassroots effort. Now this longer film is finished, and my hope is to get it out there more aggressively than the short film.
Why is female genital mutilation more than just a woman's issue? Why should it involve men?
When women are circumcised, it affects them from their childhood in many, many respects. It affects the relationships between men and women. That's actually something that many Egyptian women discussed with me, how it affects their relationship with their, you know, men. For example, in Egypt, you know, a lot of men are out smoking shisha, and there's a big problem with hash. When it affects the relationships between men and women, obviously it's a men's issue as well. And it's a human rights issue. I mean, I don't think that girls should be singled out to have this operation done when they're young. They should have some kind of choice about it. It's, you know, it's ultimately a human rights issue.
What changes are being made worldwide and especially in Africa regarding female genital mutilation?
Tremendous changes are happening throughout the world, actually, and especially in Africa. I mentioned already Egypt, and entire villages are stopping, and in particular this one village. It was started by the girls, 10-year-old girls, who are proud to call themselves the first generation not to be circumcised. So they have a lot of pride in that. And then the next village hears about it, and then they stop too. And in the case of Egypt, Susan Mubarak has started an organization to educate women and girls about stopping this practice. Tremendous changes is happening. I'm very excited about the changes, and I really do believe and hope that, you know, in the next 10 years, this practice will be eliminated. I think it is possible.
Let's think about those millions of women who have undergone female circumcision or female genital mutilation. How do you support those women?
I support those women by showing the film whenever I can and discussing the issue, you know, and encouraging them to be leaders and be open about discussing the issue. This is why, actually, there's so much success in Egypt, for example, and this concept in the villages, because this issue, it was sort of a forbidden topic for a long time. So now, for example, with cinema, the women can watch a film and speak about it. With the NGOs, you know, you have people gathering together and speaking about it. Sort of the permission to discuss is the first point in dealing with this issue. Whenever I can, I, you know, show the film to women and encourage them to think about what they're going to do, you know, with their daughters.
Surely every woman cannot be happy that you are against female genital mutilation. They may feel shamed. They may feel that this is their cultural right. What do you say to those women?
There are some people who get angry with you when you're discussing this issue, and there's a natural defensiveness, especially, you know, from women who perhaps have been circumcised. When I was making the film, trying to make the film, they said, how are you going to discuss this in a sensitive way, etc. But when people speak about cultural practices and it's my right or there's a, you know, my response is there are cultural practices that are beneficial and there are cultural practices that are harmful. People need to start thinking about cultural practices that are harmful. Those can be eliminated. Why keep on doing something when you know it's hurtful? Particularly in circumcision, women do not make the connection that they have health problems or problems because of their circumcision. So health education is a major, you know, component to this issue.
How are doctors in America reacting to your film? And especially I'm interested to find out if they're forthcoming in discussing issues of consequences and health in the future, for example, when they're doing women's health exams, for example?
I haven't been able to target, you know, many physicians just yet. I need to work more on that. You know, and I hope to get my film into the hands of some larger NGOs who can distribute it more aggressively than I can. You know, a lot of doctors that I've spoken to be quite honest, have no idea that this exists. Unless I speak to, you know, foreign doctors who are familiar with the practice, but a lot of American doctors are completely clueless about it. And that's a problem that women have faced too. Circumcised women are afraid to talk to doctors because, you know, that's the response they're going to get, which is why doctors need to be educated in particular. In America, there are some special clinics that have been created by people in this movement, especially for women who are circumcised, who are dealing with the issues of circumcision and the medical consequences they might have.
What do medical professionals in the United States and throughout the world, especially in areas where there are more and more immigrants and refugees coming from Africa and other parts of the world, need to be sensitive to about female genital mutilation?
If you want to speak to them, these are the women who are suffering. You really have to know all this, all these details about the issue. You know, what are the medical consequences and what's happening throughout the world by reading. These women, they come from, you know, anywhere. And you could be someone, for example, who had watched my film and wants to reach out to someone. And that's happened before, too, where, you know, somebody who was interested in cinema brought a girl who was Somalian to my screening just so she could discuss it with me. So people who are interested in helping these women, you know, all over, organizations and individuals, need to have a base knowledge of education. So they don't just go there and sort of be hostile or defensive with someone, you know, you should stop this, you know, this is not your right to do this, that sort of thing. It doesn't work.
Can you speak to some of the other successes that the making of this film has brought about for you?
The film has taken a very long time to make, so, you know, I'm happy to say that in every factor of the process, these women have just come out of the woodwork. I gave you Yesreya, and also during rehearsal, there were many other women on the set who are actually Africans living here in the United States, Ethiopians, Somalians, etc., who were willing to be in my film playing the extras and who brought their daughters to the set, for example, to teach them about circumcision and not to circumcise. You know, they're not circumcising their daughters, and this is why they were willing to participate in the film, even though it's a taboo subject. And that was here in Los Angeles, so that was very, very positive. The film has been screened in film festivals, which is great. I'm glad the film is an international success. My real interest is getting it out into the villages when I have the energy to go up and down, you know, Egypt and get it to the villages and get it to NGOs throughout Africa. It's a big effort, but when I can make the time for that, you know, I think the women, the film is really going to speak to the women out there who need to see the film. So that's a big success. And, you know, I am also now directing my first feature because of the short film. So it was an interesting lesson because I did have a lot of trouble making the film and I didn't give up. And, you know, I learned the lesson about that, and that's how I did meet the producer for my first feature. So, you know, that's also very exciting.
Female genital mutilation has become an issue in the United States as well as Europe, Australia, and Canada due to an increase of immigrants and refugees in these countries. According to UNICEF, of the 2 million girls who undergo female genital mutilation every year, Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, Nigeria, Somalia, and Sudan account for 75% of all cases. In Djibouti and Somalia, 98% of girls must follow this practice. The World Health Organization reports that Ghana has translated policy into law. In Burkina Faso, law cases involving deaths caused by this practice have been brought to court under existing criminal laws. In a few international cases, women have been recognized as refugees under the 1951 United Nations Convention relating to the status of refugees. Here in Oregon, a Nigerian woman sought asylum, fearing her daughters would undergo this practice if returned to Nigeria. In 1999, Oregon revised Statute Number 163.207 was enacted, making female genital mutilation illegal, a Class B felony. Under this Oregon law, medical and other people performing this procedure would be criminally charged, as well as parents and guardians. In determining any medical necessity for female genital mutilation, the Oregon law says that a child's belief that the surgery is required as a matter of custom or ritual may not be considered. There was opposition to this Oregon law, and this opposition quietly continues today, with people citing female genital mutilation as a long-standing cultural practice. Filmmaker Sarah Rashad presents and discusses her film Tahara, about female genital mutilation during Women's Filmmakers Week at the Cascade campus of the Portland Community College tomorrow evening. Her film begins at 7:30 p.m. at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building on the corner of North Albina and Killingsworth in Portland. Sarah will discuss her film following another film from Zimbabwe. The event is free of charge. This is Marianne Fry with Aaron Yankee and Sonia Damtu for KBOO's Africa on Fire. We're back live in the studio. Sonia, you were born in Eritrea and raised in Ethiopia. What's the status of female genital mutilation in the Horn of Africa?
There has been a lot of changes in the urban areas of most of the Horn of African countries. However, in rural areas, FGM is still being practiced even when it is illegal. One country in particular, Eritrea, has shown notable decline. The major reason for the decline has been the closing gap of inequality between men and women due to the 30-year independence war, which was a guerrilla war in which women fought alongside the men. Therefore, they have been empowered to stand up for themselves. And many women leading grassroots organizations and health clinics have been doing great job training in the rural areas and as well as urban areas about the health consequences of women's circumcision. But in Sudan, Somalia, Djibouti, and other areas, there's still prevalent situations where there's a lot of circumcisions being done by the elderly women in the communities.
And in Sonia, in Portland, you've worked with African refugees and immigrants for a dozen years. You've translated for African women in Oregon medical facilities. How are medical professionals dealing with circumcised African women here in Oregon?
There hasn't been many instances of female circumcisions in the African community in Portland currently, at least in the last 5 or so years since it's been illegal. Most communities understand it is illegal, and even if they want to practice it, it's been a deterrent, knowing that they could get deported and also face persecution. And however, in the African communities where African women have had the circumcision done to them, there hasn't been much progress in addressing it, whether it is in the communities or in the medical field. African women in Portland who have had undergone the procedure as children do not, for the most part, recall the event itself and don't talk about it. And because they left many of them at young age, there hasn't been a lot of continuity in discussion in the communities. So once they've been here, both refugee community and immigrant communities, there isn't a lot of openness about it. And unless there is a birth complication, the issue almost never comes up during medical exam. And medical practitioners who realize that their patients have had FGM do not know how to approach the subject itself. So they wait generally for the patient to bring up the issue if they have concern, which a lot of times they don't seem to. And quite a lot of it is because they don't realize some of the complications in their life is due to the circumcision or the genital mutilation. But what needs to be done, I think, is a lot of outreach and dialogue needs to be brought up between older and younger generation Africans. And this should be facilitated by maybe public health professionals and women community leaders. And once that comes up and open on the table and people start to discuss it, then maybe younger generation, especially those African youth that have been born here or raised in America will be the pioneers of the discussion and go on to bring up the issue with doctors and having practitioners be open about discussing it and bringing it up in during medical exams. And once the women start to begin to understand the consequences and relating the results of it to that, then they would approach their physicians with concerns. Many times when I do interpretation, the doctors, when they do realize that happens, they just seem shocked, but they don't talk about it. Occasionally, they would approach the subject at the end of it with the interpreter if the interpreter seems to be, you know, knowledgeable and speaks very good English and is inclined to want to talk about it. But most of the time, the interpreters who go with community members who don't speak English to medical exams are men, and they are not very willing to help facilitate the discussion or the concerns of women who've had that. But more and more younger people are getting into the medical field in the communities, and hopefully by getting them to start talking about it, they could represent their communities in bringing up the issues with medical centers, and especially places like OHSU, which is also a teaching hospital. They could benefit by inviting African community leaders, particularly women leaders, to come in and address the issues.
Thank you, Sonia Damtu, guest co-host for tonight's Africa on Fire program. You can find out more about tomorrow's film events at africanfilmfestival.org. To find out about distribution of Sarah's film, visit taharafilm.com. Thanks to tonight's guest, Sarah Rashad. Appreciations to Mary Holmstrom, Michael Dimbro, and Bobby Carey. Mark your calendars for the year. Africa on Fire now airs every first Thursday from 6 to 7 p.m. We are grateful to KBOO Radio for this new first Thursday slot. A very special note of appreciation to KBOO's Shahid Hamid, Wiley G. Barnett, and Lisa Loving. Email us at africaonfire@yahoo.com. Producers for tonight's show are Aaron Yankee and Rob Manning. Engineer is Kirk Vandeveer. Theme music was produced by Vancouver's African Gospel A Cappella. Elder consultants are Grace Kuto and Bosco Conte. For Africa on Fire, I'm its founder, Marianne Fry. Go connect to the great continent of light. Africa is on fire.
Africa, yeah, is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire. Africa is on fire. Africa, Africa is on fire.